Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture, brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
Welcome to the Table. We discuss issues of God and culture. I'm Daryl Bach, Executive Director for Cultural Engagement at the Hendrick Center at Dallas Theological Seminary, and we are continuing in our series on world religions, and our subject today is Jainism, which is a variation that comes out of Hinduism, so we're going to be discussing a little bit about both. And my guest, well, you're probably wondering, where is my guest? He's not with us at the table, but we are going to be interviewing him off camera for security reasons. And we're not even going to give you his name. We're going to give you a pseudonym. So, Conrad, welcome, and we appreciate your being a part of the table with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Bach, for the introduction. I look forward to the conversation.
Very good. Now, let's talk about your own interest in how you became familiar with Hinduism in general and Jainism in particular, because Jainism is probably one of the least well-known of the religions that we're going to discuss in this series, coming from northern India, involving many people there, or primarily from northern India, involving many people there, but also now has managed to come into the United States. Most people are not aware that there are at least 1,000 families, for example, in the LA area, and estimates put it at about 50,000 or so in North America. So how did you become familiar with these religions?
So God burdened me and my wife for unreached people who've never heard the gospel. And in our desire and intentionality at following his call and his heart into working with unreached people, he led us to India. And India, let's see, 1.3 billion people who have never heard the gospel before. And getting involved into India, meeting people, living life, understanding who's there. You've got 200 million Muslims. Majority of the people in India are Hindu. You've got Buddhists. And we learned that 4% of the population of India is represented by people who consider themselves as Jain. Mm-hmm. So 4% of India, 4% of 1.2 billion people are Jain. And last night I actually Googled, there's a Darasar, which is a Jain temple right here in Dallas. Mm. And I don't know how many Jains would be here in Dallas, but Jains are one of the most unreached peoples on the face of the planet. There are only a few handfuls of Jain people who have come to faith from a Jain background in the world that I know about. Mm-hmm. And so most people, in terms of mission, there's not much work going on with Jains.
Okay. So it's, I was trying to do the math real quick on what 4% of 1.2 million people would be. 10% would be 120 million. So 4% would be about 50 million probably or thereabouts. That's a significant number.
So if you meet someone from South Asia, two of the most common surnames, Jain surnames, are Shah and Mehta, and even Jain. So if you know a Shah or someone that has the last name Mehta, chances are that they are Jain for sure.
And Mehta, is that M-E-H-T-A?
That's right.
Okay. Shah is a common Indian name, yep. So it's not unusual. Okay, well, that in itself is interesting. And where did you, what region of India did you minister in?
Okay, we were in Western India, uh-huh. In the state of Gujarat, uh-huh. And we lived in the city of Ahmedabad. Mm-hmm. The heartbeat of Jain country is found in Gujarat, mm-hmm. and the southern part of Rajasthan. Okay. So the two most holy sites of Jainism, mm-hmm. are probably within a 6 to 7 hour drive from Ahmedabad.
Okay.
The most holy site of Jainism is in a place called Palitana. Uh-huh. And they believe that's where Mahavir had his enlightenment, more or less. And so it's this mountain that you climb up. There are like 3,000 stairs you climb up, and there are over 1,000 temples on the top of the mountain. Oh. And a lot of Jain pilgrims go there to rid their karma. And to, so it's a fascinating place. So if you're ever in West India, make your way to a place called Palitana, and you'll be blown away.
Okay. Now, so am I right that there was a migration in involved with Jains, or is the has it always been centered in Western India?
So Jains, can I answer you the question a long way around?
Yeah.
Now, when I said Jains represent 4% of the population of India, they own 20% of the wealth.
Okay.
And so why is that important? In order to understand Jainism and their migration patterns, you have to understand their lifestyle and why they live the way they do. And so Jains will never be farmers. They won't do anything that will involve the earth. So Jains believe in this this philosophy known as Ahimsa, which translates nonviolence.
Yes.
And so a Jain, historically, for millennia, for a long, long time, they would even be afraid to walk across a farm field or dig anything up.
They don't have anything to involve. Nonviolence includes anything having to do with death, right?
That's right.
Okay.
So they won't eat. They're strict vegetarians, so they will not eat root vegetables.
Right.
So no carrots, no garlic, no leeks, no onions, no potatoes. And so because
vegans on steroids.
Vegans on steroids, for sure, right? And so because of these beliefs, they had to find modes of work that would allow them to protect and stick true to their convictions. And so what job will allow them to do that? Pushing numbers. So most accountants in India, almost all the accountants I know in India are Jain in Gujarat. So I had a team of accountants that were all Jain. So pushing numbers, they're really good with math, they're really good with business. They own companies, and so they might, let's say, own a farm, but they're not going to work on the farm, right? So they're going to make tons of money. And because they're enterprising, because they're entrepreneurial, they can go anywhere in the world. And like I said, 20% of the wealth of India is owned by Jains. So my accountant he comes from a very wealthy family. So think of 1960, 1970s India. His family owned 70 vehicles in India, right? So some of the wealthiest guys in India, you think of like Adani, who's one of Modi's trusted advisors. He's a big time business guy all around the world, billionaire. A lot of the billionaires and multimillionaires are all Jain.
And you said that explains the migration pattern. So
that would be my guess. I've never heard that before.
So let's back up. Jainism comes out of Hinduism. So we haven't talked much about Hinduism in the series yet. So let's talk about Hinduism a little bit and the relationship between it and Jainism.
Okay, so Hinduism is this extant, well, you first have to ask yourself, what is Hinduism? Is it a religion or is it a civilization? Because in reality, there are basically, what I like to say, a million Hinduisms.
Yeah, sure.
And so in light of that, there were a lot of reform movements that came from Hinduism. Buddhism was one, and Jainism was another one. So Mahavir was a Hindu. And there were several things he was unhappy with. Corruption in the Hindu temples was one of them. But Hinduism and Jainism share a lot of the same concepts, like the Ahimsa, the vegetarianism. Jains will worship different Tirthankars. So a Tirthankar is basically so Mahavir would be considered the last Tirthankar or the first. I mix this up. So when you go to Palitana, for instance, as you're climbing the mountain, there are different places and stages where you worship different Jain religious gurus of the past.
And a Jain, just to explain, is someone who has achieved this kind of, for lack of a better description, super spirituality that is the goal of Jainism?
You would be born into a Jain family. That's how you become a Jain.
Okay.
And I know of one Hindu guy who was Hindu, and he paid a pujari, a priest, to do a certain kind of puja to become a Jain. So so there are ways to pay money to kind of change your caste or your religion in India, in like the Hindu worldview. But basically, I'm sorry, what was your question?
At the top of the Jain chain, if I can say it that way, are these people who have become spiritually pure, if I can say it that way. They're at the top of the... So the people that you're worshiping as you move up this this ladder on the mountain. These are people who have achieved
nirvana,
a certain level of spirituality.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And so, like, they believe Mahavir attained moksha.
Right.
And so moksha, this idea of release from the cycle of samsara, of rebirth and redeath.
Right.
And karma and kali. So, you know, Hindus will call it nirade grantis, knots of the heart.
Uh-huh.
So for a lot of Hindus, there are three problems, and in some ways this would apply to Jains. So you have avidya, kama, and karma. So avidya translates as ignorance, and so it's like you are ignorant to the fact that you are God, God is in you, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The ignorance is driven by kama, which is like a desire. So, you know, you have these desires that are produced by ignorance, which lead to you having to do certain acts and deeds to kind of quench this understanding for the true knowledge and the truth that you are God and God is in you. And then it's all melded together, and different Jains believe different things. And so there are two main sects of Jainism,
mm-hmm.
The Digambras,
mm-hmm.
and it's slipping my mind right now, the other one. But the Digambras are, you'll hear sometimes of these Jain priests that will walk around naked in India.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like this idea of wearing clothes could harm an insect or an animal. That's why they don't wear clothes, because the idea of ahimsa is so important to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so if, like, I would go into Jain temples in our city, and the priests, they would wear these masks over their mouth and their nose for fear of inhaling a bug or a fly or a mosquito, that kind of thing. And so they really go to the extreme of looking out for life, even to the fact, like, a lot of my Jain friends in India, they would not eat dinner after sunset,
mm-hmm.
because they, when it goes dark, they want to make sure they can see what they're putting in their mouth.
Hmm.
And so they're very devoted. They're very, and granted, keep in mind, there are exceptions. Like, there are, you know, there are Jains who would be secret non-vegetarians,
mm-hmm.
and I had plenty of those.
Mm-hmm.
And but generally speaking, Jains are pretty strict and austere people.
The second group that you're talking about, I think now I may botch this pronunciation, but it looks like it's Sheve Tambara.
Okay.
So we've got these different groups. It's a form of, well, let's stay on Hinduism for a second. Hinduism is so different from Christianity that I think we just need to stop and realize how different it is. There's no, let's start at the basics when we think about this theologically. There's no creator God, correct?
They call it the Trimurti.
Mm-hmm.
And so the three main gods in Hinduism, now keep in mind, in the Hindu pantheon, there are 330 million gods and goddesses.
Uh-huh.
And that's according to Diana Eck out of the Ecumenical Center at Harvard University. And okay. I don't know how she came up with that number. And I don't know how
I hope she didn't miss one along the way.
But Hindus will talk about the Trimurti. So Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Shiva is the lord of destruction, god of the demons. Vishnu is the preserver. So, like, the various dasavatars, the various incarnations.
Mm-hmm.
So when the world is in danger, and the gods need to save it, Vishnu will send his avatar to kind of save the world. And then Brahman is kind of like they might say he's the creator god, but in the sense that we understand it, it would be totally different.
Yeah.
Not like we understand it.
Okay, because my next question was going to be, what about the creation? Is it created, or has it always existed?
There are different myths and understandings, you know, whether, like, you know, from a grain of rice to, so I mean, where the creation comes from, but there's...
It's actually not a question they're very concerned with. Is that true?
No,
yeah,
no,
yeah.
No,
so
no.
I'm just trying to point out here and pick out how this is really significantly different than anything we think about in the West.
So when you think about, there's a Hindu concept known as Atman,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it's this universal consciousness that is in you, and it's in me, and it's the God soul that
mm-hmm.
exists, and that's what's always existed, right, from before time began or whatever. And so all of this, some Hindus believe all of this that we experience in life is an illusion, right? And so you're living life, and you have this fatalistic view of what will be, and it's all based on, you know, whatever. There's so many different schools of Hinduism, but, like, if you're you know, you're living your life and you're trying to follow your dharma and your caste, and you know, there's certain things that you're supposed to do and you're not supposed to do, and it improves your karma or takes away your karma, and that will determine your next birth. And so it's this endless cycle of rebirth and redeath, and mm-hmm. you're trying to escape from that, right? You're trying to it's a never-ending mess.
Okay, well, again, I'm going to help have you define terms here. So dharma is?
So when you talk to a Hindu will never refer, if they're talking in their main language, if they're talking in Hindi, mm-hmm. they will never refer to their belief system as a religion.
Mm-hmm.
Hindus call their belief system Sanatana Dharma. So basically, dharma it's an all-encompassing concept of truth, righteousness, law, fate, order. It's this idea of how everything fits together. And so Sanatana Dharma, it basically translates the eternal faith.
Hmm.
So when a Hindu thinks about Christianity, they refer to it as Videshi Dharma.
Hmm.
So this concept of dharma is foundational. If you really want to understand Hinduism, you've got to understand the idea of dharma. And so the swastika, which we get the word swastika, it's a Hindu symbol.
Mm-hmm.
And the four points of the swastika refer to like the four goals in dharma. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of dharma, it's supposed to, you know, your wealth, your life, your family, you know, all these things are working together, and it's the circle of life. And so dharma is also determined by your caste. And so if you're born in a high caste family, you have a certain dharma that you follow. If you're born in a low caste family, you have another dharma that you follow.
So again, just for analogy's sake, so people get it, caste is kind of like your social status or social standing, or is it more comprehensive?
So in Hindi, they call it varna and jati. Mm-hmm. And so basically it's the idea of class and caste.
Uh-huh.
So like there are four major classes of people. So the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaisyas, and the Shudras, and so basically in these four classes you would have thousands of castes. And the Indian government actually puts out a book about that thick of all of the castes in India.
He went that thick, everybody. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
So they're scheduled castes, they're forward castes, and all of these castes historically kind of represent all of the roles and functions in society. And so your caste in a lot of cases will determine who you can marry, who you can't marry, your profession, your job, what life is going to be like for you, and that kind of thing.
So it's a very ordered religion in one sense.
It is.
Okay, so I guess the next question would be, anything else on Hinduism that we need in order to understand Jainism?
The important thing, and one of the things when I'm talking to a church or to a group of people about Hindus, is you can never assume anything about a Hindu, because if there literally are a million Hinduisms, the best way to learn what a Hindu believes is to develop a relationship with a Hindu family and just pepper them with questions to understand where they're coming from, so you can communicate more skillfully in terms of understanding who they are, what their worldview is, how they think, how they approach life. And in terms of, you know, loving them with your life, with your time, and with your witness, it's really important when dealing with Hindus to define terms or to seek clarification on things they say. So that's what I would say. And that, because there are atheist Hindus, there are agnostic Hindus, there are polytheistic Hindus, there are Hindus. So like you take the BAPs, the Swami Narayan Hindus, that's one branch. You have the Brahma Kumaris, you have the Hare Krishnas, you've got various sampradayas. So sampradaya is kind of like a denomination.
Hmm.
You've got various gurus from, you know, you think of guys like Rajneesh or Deepak Chopra.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you've got, so it's really hard to nail down. And the Arya Samaj, for instance, like a lot of people, when they think about Hindus, they think about people who worship like an idol made of stone. But the Arya Samaj group, they reject that, and they don't believe in an actual like icon or an idol. And so there's just so much out there that it just takes time and questions.
And a significant part of India is Hindu in faith, right?
Yeah, about 80-85% for sure. And then 70% of India lives in the village, and 30% lives in the urban setting. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, and you've got folky type Hinduism,
sure,
involved with like a lot of black magic and witchcraft and all that kind of stuff, and especially a lot of the village settings. And even like, you know, when you go, it's all tied together, even with, you know, educated Hindus. I mean, you think about this, the prime minister of India at the time, his name was Atal Bihari Vajpayee. Mm-hmm. He was, I think this would have been back when Bill Clinton was president. This guy was the super educated. He was the leader of one of the largest democracies in the world, now the largest democracy in the world. And this guy worshipped at the feet, was it Sai Baba? And Atal Bihari Vajpayee talked about having, like, I call them like LSD trips and like visiting the moon and going to different places, right? So you've got people who have had some crazy experiences, who claim some extraordinary things. You know, you've got people who are a little bit more rational or grounded. You've got people who can't read, who are devoted to certain gods or goddesses. I mean, it's a one huge smorgasbord.
So 80% of 1.2 million is about 900 million. I mean, it's one of the largest religions in the world.
Yeah. And in America, there are over 3 million South Asian Indian people. So if you follow those percentages, so let's say 80% of 3 million, you could probably guesstimate that's how many Hindus are in America. Mm. The city I live in Toronto, we have about 500,000 to 700,000 people from India. 200,000 to 300,000 of them are Sikhs. We've got, so I mapped out 70 Hindu temples in our city in Toronto. And to put that in perspective, the state of New Jersey has the most Hindu temples out of any state in America. And the entire state, they have 30. At least that was several years ago. So the sun never sets on the Indian diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to any country in the world and you will find Hindu people. They're, you know, Indians are very enterprising.
Mm-hmm.
They're very smart, very intelligent. They're very hardworking. They love money. They love making money. And so, you know, whether you're an East African, I have friends working with Hindus in Tanzania, in Dar es Salaam, in Nairobi, in Mauritius, in Europe, all in Dallas. I mean, Hindus are everywhere.
Okay. Well, you've already mentioned this principle of nonviolence, which is, what is it?
Ahimsa.
And a lot of the concepts we're going to talk about here, people are not very familiar with, but if I can just give one kind of bridge so that people can kind of understand, my understanding is that Mahatma Gandhi was very influenced by Jainism in his whole approach to life and politics, and this nonviolent feature was one of the key parts of what was a part of his approach to life.
That's right. And Gandhi was born in Porbandar, Gujarat, which is kind of in the middle of the Saurashtrian Peninsula on the Arabian Sea.
Mm-hmm.
So Gandhi was Gujarati, and Jainism is like, in Gujarat, Jainism is the epicenter.
Mm-hmm.
So he would have for sure had Jain friends. He was a Hindu, and he would have understood Mahavira. He would have understood all of these concepts. And so Ahimsa is both shared in Jainism as well as Hinduism.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, So Gandhi in his Satyagraha movement, you know, like when they did the Dandi Salt March, for instance, mm-hmm. Gandhi told all of his followers, like, we will not fight, like, we won't hit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the British had given us salt tax. And Gandhi's like, you know, this is our country. And they went to one salt farm, I think. And the British knew they were going to be there, and they had batons. And Gandhi told them, like, we're going to go collect salt, but we won't fight back. And so this idea of Ahimsa saw these Hindu and probably Jain people walking along the beach to the salt farm, getting whacked in the head by clubs and not fighting back. And so that the idea of ahimsa not only applies politically, but it also applies with diet and clothing and one's vocation in India if you're Jain.
So it's an extreme, I'm trying to be descriptive here, it's an extreme asceticism, right? That distances itself from attachment to anything earthly.
Yeah, so I'll tell you a story. So
okay.
I was, we were working in India and I was doing an audit for my books and my accountant team was comprised of all Jain guys, and so we're working. And when we were finished with the audit, the lead accountant, who is a strict Jain, he looks at me and he says, "Clinton," he says, "Conrad, do you know why there are so many wars in the world?" And I had an idea where he was going to go with this, and so I said, "Tell me why are there so many wars in the world?" And he's like, "It's because of all the meat eaters, right?" And so I said, well, tell me about that. He's like, "Well, you know, anyone that takes the life of an animal is a violent person. And that violence is just there, and it makes the world a bad place. And so that, like, that's the mindset. And the city that we lived in, the fact was, there were very wealthy Jain people that were looking up to buy restaurants that served meat just to close them down."
Uh-huh.
Right? And so,
okay.
So you know,
yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Huh. So, and so the key, I mean, this faith doesn't have a doctrine really other than this nonviolence and this preservation of life, this desire to be unattached to the world. There are vows that involve the nonviolence. There are vows that are tied, I think, to not receiving anything that hasn't been freely given to you, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are cultural variations depending mm-hmm. upon, like, where you come from or what sect
mm-hmm.
or just even, you know, it's kind of like Hinduism in the sense of you know, even with the two distinctions of the two types of Jains, like even with those, and so they could have interesting outlooks and interesting ideas on, you know, how they interact with people or what you're saying, like gift, you know, yeah. So
that there's an emphasis on truthfulness and integrity.
Yeah, for sure.
Now I have one of the vows as being celibacy, which is interesting because it seems to me that's a way not to perpetuate your clan, so to speak.
So Hindus would call that brahmacharya.
Uh-huh.
And so basically, when you take a vow of celibacy, so the current prime minister of India is mm-hmm. that. Like, mm-hmm. he's taken a vow of celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another interesting story. But so when you decide to do that, it shows that you're a spiritual person and you want to give your life to the causes of God
mm-hmm.
or you know, to what you believe. And so there are, if you were to go to Palitana, for instance, this Jain holy place, I've been there several times and you can tell those people by what they wear.
Hmm.
So if you see a woman wearing all white in the mm-hmm. Jain holy place, you know, she's taken that vow.
Huh.
Right. And she's dedicated herself to the purposes of God. And so there are cultural markers that you can pick up on with certain people to understand kind of like their level of devotion and that kind of thing.
Hmm. Another vow that I see here, well, we've already mentioned this, the non-attachment to worldly possession. I mean, so much so that a strict Jain, my understanding is, moves from place to place and doesn't have a home or anything like that. Is that true?
From my own personal uh-huh. experience, I don't know how much that happens anymore.
Uh-huh. Used to be.
It would have definitely...
Yeah.
They might have referred to it as a sannyasin.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, the different stages of life in, like, the Hindu worldview where you're a child, then you're a student, and then you're kind of, like, growing into adulthood, and then you renounce things... And you might become a hermit in a forest, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure that happens still, but I don't think it probably happens as much, especially in the modern world.
I see. Yeah, in fact, one of the comments that was made in the, at least the preparation and reading I was doing is that the modern world has injected terrific pressure on pure Jainism.
Yeah.
Because it's harder, it's becoming harder and harder to live this way.
So I'll give you a perfect example of that. So I have Jain friends who are business guys who do international business. And I know for a fact, because they've told me this, like when they come to New York City, let's say, finding a restaurant that serves pure Jain food, you can't find one.
Uh-huh.
And so... like, I've had Jain friends tell me, okay, well, in that case, we'll go to a vegetarian restaurant and we will eat garlic.
Uh-huh.
We will eat onions because, you know.
Yeah.
And so they will compromise, especially if they're traveling on business. And so, yeah.
And the premise of that is that my understanding is that they want to eat that which has the least sensibility in some sense. That's my paraphrase for it, but there's some sense of orderliness of consciousness that different living beings have, and so they're working down the scale to do the least amount of damage possible in the killing.
Yeah, because if you're so they wouldn't eat those things, because if they were to dig in the ground,
uh-huh.
it has the potential to kill things,
right?
And so there's almost it's taboo. And so it would really violate many of their consciousness to do that. And so, like, I'll tell you another story. So I was, when I first moved to India, looking at business opportunities, the reason I chose to work with, a particular accountant was because my German friend who introduced me said to this guy, you need to meet my accountant. And so he's telling me this story and he says that, when Johan met, we'll call him Rajiv, learned that Johan wanted to build a chicken manufacturing processing plant. And so Rajiv says, look, Johan, I hope you do really well. I hope, you know, you make lots of money. But unfortunately, I cannot use my services to set up your company because I feel like it's taking the life of innocent creatures, and you'll have to find someone else to do that for you. And so when he said that, the fact that he would turn away money for the sake of his convictions, you know, that led me to work with him.
Huh. Interesting. So part of what we're dealing with here is this is such a different kind of faith, if I can say it that way. It really represents a completely different way of thinking about the world, completely different way of thinking about reality, completely different way of thinking about salvation. And yet one of the principles that we're wrestling with here, once we kind of explain what a faith is about, is asking the question, so what causes someone to be attracted to this? What is the point of adhering to this kind of way of life?
That's a great question, and I'll answer it by saying, so when, you know, think about when you were growing up, right? And if you were raised by your parents or a guardian, you probably had your favorite dish maybe that your mom made. So you come home from school and you smell your mom cooking this delicious food, right? And you have memories of like, oh, that, you know, that's... And so for a Jain, it's kind of like that, I think, and for a Hindu as well. It's like you grew up with it, right? You're born into this family.
This is the world you know.
This is your culture.
Yeah.
And it impacts your relationships. It impacts the people you know, the food that you eat, the rites of passage that you have. It impacts how you... The filter and the grid in which you learn to see the world around you comes from all of that unspoken stuff that you learn by watching those that you love. And so the reason why Jains are Jain and the reason why Hindus are Hindu is because they're born into it, right? Mm-hmm. And these religions, if you want to call them, inform their entire worldview.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why Jains are Jain.
Let me ask you one other question about content, which I forgot to ask that I should. You've alluded to, I don't know if it's worship is the right term, but the kind of honor that is given in the and I'm assuming that there are temples and that kind of thing associated with Jains. Is that right?
They're referred to as Derasars. Uh-huh. Derasar. So if you Google Derasar, if you are there any Derasars near my location, and it'll tell you, yes, there are temples. They will go to temples. They'll have pujas. Puja is a worship service.
Okay.
They'll have all different kinds of things. They'll have singing. There will be idols in a lot of cases of the Tirthankars, and the Tirthankars are these kind of these former people who, like Mahavira, who attained moksha, right?
Okay. Which is the highest status you can attain, so liberation of the soul
from samsara.
Yeah. And so it's a kind of honoring of those who have made it?
Yeah. I mean, it could be that for sure. And and doing things like that improve your karma, and so the more you can improve your karma, the better.
Okay.
And so the better your karma, your next birth, they call it Janam Din, you have a better chance of coming back as something better.
Okay. If I can say it this way, the reward in the religion is by being a better kind of person, you get a better next life.
You could boil down to that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got this background. We've got this adherence. And I can understand this. You've said that Jains are very, very hard to evangelize. And so, but when you think about how the gospel speaks into a Jain's life, what do you think of?
I am really big on pursuing becoming a skillful cross-cultural communicator.
Uh-huh.
People really are different. And in order to communicate in such a way, understanding has to take place first. And so, in order to communicate in a skillful way with a Jain, you've got to know what they know. I'm more familiar with Hindus.
Right.
And so the gospel impacts every area of life. It addresses issues of origin, of destiny, of meaning, of significance. It affirms the fact that men and women are created in God's image. It gives us hope. It gives us something to live for. And, in these South Asian cultures, especially Hinduism and Jainism, we'll take women, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Being a woman is not an easy thing in these places. And so when skillful communication is happening and people understand, what was it, like Paul in, I think it was Acts 17:20.
Yeah, we're talking about in Athens.
You remember where they said to him, Paul, you're bringing some strange things to our ears.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And so for me, I think the gospel would be considered strange things to these ears.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And for me, like, that's part of the hope, in that it's a different message, and one that I believe is rooted in truth, in the truth of God, right? It's true. And so taking pains to make sure that I communicate in such a way that these people understand exactly what I'm saying and what I'm not saying, but I've got to know what they know, because if I don't know what they know, our communication might miss each other.
Yeah, we've talked about in this series throughout what I call getting a spiritual GPS on someone, which basically means listening,
yeah.
and initially not worrying about correcting, but just coming to a point of understanding what drives the person spiritually.
Yeah. One of my mottos I live by is I prefer clarity over agreement.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so if I can make sure that I know them and they know me, it'll help me in how I transmit the gospel message in the life of Jesus to people who have never heard of him before.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the hard part here is that, and again, I'll make a comparison to Acts 17 just so we kind of have a point of reference. When Paul begins with an audience that doesn't know Genesis from Malachi, they don't know anything about the Bible at all. He starts with the understanding of accountability to a creator God. And they do, in the Greco-Roman world, they do understand transcendent spirits and that kind of thing, because there's a lot of religious practice around that involves a lot of religious activity in the broadest sense of that term. But here you're talking about a whole orientation that doesn't even have that dimension of it in a significant way. I mean, there might be the awareness of transcendent power or presence or that kind of thing, but it isn't, maybe it is. You said there were
30 million
gods in Hinduism, but there's not that personal, direct, singular accountability that the Christian faith has. So that's a big hurdle.
Yeah, and reaching people from South Asia is not for the faint of heart. Mm-hmm. And it, whether you're from India or whether you're from outside of India, it's a life work. Like, it's going to require investment. I mean, we've been doing this for 16 years, and we're always learning. Like, and one of my mentors would always say, Conrad, there are things you can control and there are things you can't control, right? You can control how you spend your time with people, what you say to them. You can learn how to communicate. But at the end of the day, it's the work of the Holy Spirit convicting of sin.
Sure.
You know, and so in trying to reach these people, and by the way, we need more champions for Hindus and Jains, because there aren't many people trying to reach them, mm-hmm. both here and there. Mm. And so, and that's why I'm excited to kind of encourage people who might be listening that. So I asked the question today to a group of people. I asked them, if you decide to invest your life, to give your love, your life, and your witness to a Hindu or Jain family, the question was, what is the probability that you would be the first one in the entire lineage of their family for the last 2,000 years to introduce the gospel? Hmm. Like, you would be the first one to do that. And if the statistic is true that 95% of 1.2 billion people in India have never heard the gospel, it makes me wonder, like, wow, like, you talk about what an opportunity and a privilege from the Creator to try to introduce people to the one who made them. I mean, yeah.
And of course, one of the challenges in India now in the social and political situation is it's becoming more restrictive in terms of gaining access for the gospel in the country. And so that's become a problem. But the other flip side of this, as you already mentioned, is with the India diaspora, you have people who are Indian who literally are located all around the world.
Absolutely. The current missions paradigm is changing and will be changed within 20 years. Finding, I'll say this, the current Indian government doesn't like Videshi Dharma, the religion of the foreigner, but they love money. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, concerned Christians that want to make a difference in South Asia, if they're coming from outside of Asia, they're going to have to start businesses. To both fund the work of God, but then also to reach people in and through the workplace. And, what they say, 90% of people who tithe in the local church in North America are in the baby boomer generation or older. And so finding alternative funding streams for there. But even here, it's like, yeah, God has given a prime opportunity to reach people from limited access and restricted access countries on our doorstep. Like, I asked a lot of people today, how many of you work with a Hindu, know a Hindu, and almost everyone raised, Dallas, every day, 400 to 500 people move to Dallas. 100 of those are from India.
Hmm.
It's amazing. So yeah. Dallas, we were actually praying about moving to Dallas to do this before we went to Toronto, but Dallas is the fastest growing population of South Asian Indians all of America.
Wow. So that means it's possible. We just have a couple of minutes left, so let me ask you this. What advice would you give beyond just getting to know and doing a lot of listening to someone who wants to think about interacting with a Jain or a Hindu for that matter?
There, with both Jains and Hindus, there are two barriers you have to overcome. Two barriers. The first barrier is the social barrier, mm-hmm. and the second barrier is the spiritual barrier. Mm-hmm. So most Jains and Hindus aren't going to listen to anything you have to say unless they accept you for who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to go to where they are. And I'm a big believer of not having expectations on lost people and taking the gospel to them. And so, you know, find a local Indian market. And in every Indian market, they're going to have a magazine that advertises and broadcasts where the South Asian community does life, events that are coming up, cricket leagues. And so go get plugged in, go find where people are and just immerse yourself. Find people who are open to you. And if someone's open to you, you invite them into your world. You know, hey, let's meet with a cup of chai. Let's do this. And you start doing stuff with people. You start building a relationship. So the key is you want to find people who accept you for who you are and then who will respond to the invitation to come into your life. Then you've got to address the spiritual barrier. You want to introduce Jesus into the equation. So you're listening for needs with your new friend. You know, they say, oh, my mom has cancer. And then, you know, you say, hey, can I come over and we'll have a prayer ceremony in Jesus's name. And so Jains and Hindus are all about experience. And so you want them to experience the power of prayer and to see how you live your life. And you really want to invest your life in. I'll leave it at that, but just remember the social barrier and the spiritual barrier and just get involved. Just do something.
Well, Conrad, I thank you for coming in and helping us with Hinduism and Jainism. These are probably largely foreign worlds to our audience, so I thank you for introducing them to us. We thank you for being part of the table. Hope you found the discussion interesting and hope you'll join us again soon.
Thanks for listening to The Table Podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.